Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere. Today's guest, Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State and losing Democratic candidate for Senate last year. The guy from that ad with the rifle that he takes apart blindfolded. Why talk to a guy who lost, no matter how close he came? Well, kind of insanely, given how far away we are from the next presidential election. I've been to New Hampshire twice already this spring. One was for a big dinner Joe Biden spoke at in the Manchester Radisson. The second was to record this interview, which we also actually did in the Manchester Radisson, but in a smaller room upstairs. Biden, when he was there, insisted he isn't running for president. Kander, when I asked him about president too, said there's no way that that's why he was in town. But you know what? He's been all over the country, including going to Iowa twice now. I know it's crazy, but people have actually said to me, maybe Kander will just run for president himself. But that's not what's interesting about him to me. That event in Manchester was just one of three he did that weekend there in Massachusetts and Kentucky. That's a pretty average weekend for him. There is no one in politics that I've seen who has done this well by losing. He got himself 100,000 Twitter followers. Joe Biden sees him as sort of like his dead son, Beau. They have a similar profile. Both of them were in the army, got into politics, and Biden has kind of adopted him. A lot of people in Obama world have kind of adopted him. In January, the last interview that Obama did when he was president, he was asked who's the future of the Democratic Party, and the first name he came up with was Jason Kander. Again, a guy who lost. And Democratic groups all over the country keep inviting him to come. So I said to him, why? And he said, all I can tell you is what people say when they invite us. They say they want me to come talk about the future of the party and how we were able to run 16 points ahead. That's 16 points ahead of Hillary Clinton. Now, the first time I talked to Kander last spring, when he was running for Senate then, and most people weren't paying much attention to him, it was over the phone, and he said to me, there are a lot of Trump Kander voters in Missouri. And I told him, like, that's a good line for the stump, but I wasn't going to run it. And it turns out he was right. There are about 220,000 people who fit that description. And you'll hear him talk that through, along with his stories about how he joined the Army after September 11th, after getting turned away from giving blood at the Capitol, the time he told Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach that Kobach was trying to keep black people from voting, essentially, and what happened when he made a big deal out of voting rights in his final speech to the Missouri State Legislature back in January. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac DeVere, and on Facebook, email me at isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Jason Kander. Let's start on election night last year. The way that I've been told it, there were about an hour, 2 hours when you thought that you had won, that you were a senator, and also realized that Donald Trump was going to be the president. What's that period like?
That's close. I mean, it wasn't, I mean, from my perspective, it wasn't quite that I thought I had won. But I definitely thought I was winning, and that looked like a likely possibility. But I'm not sure that I even at that point had fully digested the idea in any way that it looked like Donald Trump was going to be president. Frankly, I'm not sure that hit me for real until I woke up in the middle of the night that night, and I woke my wife up, and I was like, I think they're going to repeal Obamacare, and I remember that.
That's a little too good to be true.
No, I swear, and I just remember that hit me because it wasn't just, oh, we lost the election, like we nationally mm-hmm. lost the election. It took that long for me to fully digest what all this meant, and not even fully, but just partially. And I remember in that conversation, because my younger brother and his wife are on the exchange, and so I just remember that. So, but in answer to your question, I never really fully, I don't think, got to digest the idea that I thought I was going to be in the Senate while he was president. I was just, I think like everybody else, I was just watching it thinking this isn't really happening.
Like him, it seems like at that moment too.
Yeah.
When you wake your wife up in the middle of the night and say, I think they're going to repeal Obamacare, does she say to you, like, let's come back to sleep? Or
I think that, no, not, I mean, usually, yes, that's what would happen. But no, that night it was, she understood, like she was upset too. And so we talked about it, and I, you know, we were alternating who was actually getting sleep really. So
you gave a speech to your campaign staff that included a line, something like, if you leave politics, I'm going to hunt you down and come after you. Was that then an accurate representation?
That was my part of my concession speech. We never wrote a concession speech. And so I quote unquote wrote the concession speech as I was walking out to the stage and thinking, you know, I needed to say something here. And what I remember thinking, what I remember being sort of the overwhelming feeling that I had at that moment was I had a really strong, I mean, really the right word is fear for the country that my own generation in particular would see something as devastating as Donald Trump being elected president, and it could be like a really crushing blow. Now, it turns out, as we sit here, it's been very much the opposite of that, and I'm really relieved and pleased about that. But that was the overwhelming thought I had, was I was worried that people would just say, no, this isn't right. This isn't worth my time. And so what I was trying to say to everybody was, and I don't remember how I phrased it, but I was basically saying, look, the country's been through really difficult things. And patriotism, one form of patriotism, is caring deeply about the direction of your country and the politics of your country as much when you lose as when you win. That you can't decide I'm going to care about this when it feels really good. I mean, and many would argue that you should care about it more. I would argue when it's not going the way that you want. And that's what I was trying to get across. That was, in my mind, that was me saying to people, like, this is not an excuse for you to quit. You will not get a pass from me. Like, I will be calling and saying you need to stay involved.
And do you feel like it had the effect on your staff? It seems like most people have stayed involved in some way or another, right?
I do, actually, yeah. I mean, I don't know, I can't measure to the larger audience, but certainly to the folks who, you know, whether it's staff or volunteers, people like that, the people for whom I was my campaign or my time in office has been sort of their vehicle into political activism. Yeah, certainly quite a few of them have called me to talk about what jobs are going to take and that sort of thing.
So the story is that you, after 9/11, enlisted, but in fact you had torn your ACL, right?
Yeah.
What, how'd you tear your ACL?
I was in a pickup football game in college is what happened. And my very good friend, who was, I think, an all-state free safety in Texas, and I had a nice rivalry going. And by the way, the funny part of the story now, funny, is that I was the guy saying, we're not playing touch, we're playing tackle, which looking back was kind of dumb. Anyway, so he tore my ACL.
You feel bad about it?
He took very good care of me. And we still have an argument going as to whether or not I was in the end zone when this happened. Anyway, long story short.
Did you win the game, though?
That I don't even remember, because I think really that whole thing was just me and him in a rivalry. I think that's all we cared about. But anyway, so yeah.
So you have to go into rehab, though.
Yeah, at that point, I mean, which is the point of your question. At that point, I had already decided, it was, you know, 9/11 had happened, and I had decided, like, I'm going in to the military. And then this happened, and yeah, so I had to get...
Why is that? Surgery. I mean, a lot of people had different responses to 9/11. Mm-hmm. I was in college myself. A year older than you, I guess, right? So you were junior, probably? Right?
It was my last year. It was supposed to be my junior year.
Okay.
My wife finished school real quick, and I was trying to catch up to her. So.
That was a reason to finish. I did not enlist. Other people, but I grew up not far from the Twin Towers. It affected everybody. Why is enlisting the response? What's that thought process at that time? Well, is it family members or others that got you thinking about that?
Sort of. I grew up in a really public service oriented home. My parents were juvenile probation officers, and my dad was a cop at night. And they never had to tell us, you're supposed to do things for others. It was just through their example. So, like, we refer to them as my unofficial foster brothers. We don't know how else really to refer to them. But I grew up with a bunch of brothers, an adopted younger brother, and then a bunch of kids who my parents took in because their families were struggling. And there was no conversation around the dining room table with my younger brother and I, you know, you guys will have to share a lot. There was no family meeting. They just did that. So just in all their actions, I was just sort of raised to understand you help when you're needed. And when you see something that you feel like maybe you should do to help, then you should.
But is there a thought process about is it a long thought process about enlisting after 9/11 or is it just like, you see it happen and say, all right, I'm going into the Army.
So let me finish the backstory and then I'll tell you my thought process that day. So the other part of the backstory is, for me, like, I don't come from like a long military career family or anything. I mean, my grandfather was in World War II and my great-grandfather in World War I. But they were like a whole lot of Americans who, they weren't in the military. The war started, they went, they served, they did their duty, they went home. And there was something about that that I just always really admired. But more than that, there was something about that that just made a lot of sense to me. It just, growing up, that just made sense to me. And I sort of looked at the military as something, it was for me in the category that I refer to as the maybe one day category. It was, you know, I think maybe one day I'd like to do this, but I had no plan to do it, no concrete plan. I don't know whether I ever would have actually done it. So then 9/11 happens, and I'm in D.C. because I was going to school there, and I had this overwhelming feeling, like this refrain in my mind that was like, I have to do something. That's what I kept saying to myself in my mind. And so my roommates and I went down near the Capitol to, because we found out you could go down there and give blood. And we were standing in line for a long time, like maybe a couple hours. It felt like that long.
Like on 9/11 and stuff. In that period, that day, when everybody was giving blood, and then it turned out that like nobody actually needed the blood, right?
Yeah, which I didn't even know until you just told me that. I didn't, you know?
Well, it was just because there were not that many survivors.
Yes, right, exactly. So we're standing in line, and then a nurse or whoever was taking blood came out after a long time of standing in line and said to everybody there, we've run out of the capacity to take any more blood. Hopefully you can find another way to help. And just in that moment, I just remember thinking, I'm gonna join the military. And I guess my family knew me well enough, and I had, you know, just been a certain way growing up, that when I got home that night, I had emails from family members who, you know, I mean, you probably remember that day, you couldn't get a phone call out. So when it happened, you were emailing people back home like, I'm okay. And the response emails were the normal, I love you, I'm glad you're okay. But I remember my brother, who was living in Denver, said, I know you're going to join the military, but don't join today. And so clearly they knew me well.
Better than you knew you.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Right, because you would not have thought that you were in that space, right?
Yeah, in my mind, I was like, I'm figuring out how I'm going to do this. And I remember...
What did you email him back?
I don't remember.
Like, too late? Like,
I don't remember. I don't remember if I did email him back. It was such a, you know...
There's a lot that was going on that
right,
day.
Right, it was such an awful day.
Is it that same thought process once you get back after you did ROTC, right? You were in intelligence. I think we all... know that you knew how to take apart a gun, put one back together along the way, that leads when you're back home in Missouri to think about running for office? Or is it a long run up, or is it just was there another like Red Cross nurse that gets you?
Well, you know, I had thought about running and it was even when I deployed, was thinking about it before I left. But really what being in Afghanistan, the difference that it made for me sort of politically, so to speak, is it has everything to do with how I think about politics, in the sense that, you know, I grew up comfortably. I mean, there was nobody who was in public office who could, you know, make a decision that would take food off my family's table or anything like that. So the first time that I ever had the experience of being on the receiving end of a decision that negatively affected my life, a political decision, I was in Afghanistan. I was outside the wire a lot of days in my job. You know, I was in a vehicle outside the wire, and it was pretty rare that I was in one that was armored. You know, and look, a lot of people did a lot more than I did. But thinking about those things and thinking about how that happened, thinking about missions where we were told we were gonna, like, I can think of one in particular where we were gonna have helicopters to go to eastern Afghanistan, and then a day before or so found out we were doing it by vehicle, which was a very dangerous way to travel through that route. And I remember somebody saying to me, and I don't know whether they were right or wrong, but I remember this registering them saying to me, you know, well, the helicopter assets are being moved to Iraq for the most part.
It's not an indiscernible line, but it's not exactly a direct line between worrying about helicopter assets in Afghanistan to running for state house in Missouri, right? Because
not
that
a direct
job,
line.
I see how you got there in a way, but is that, was it a process of thinking whether that's the right thing to do? That, and then you end up going door to door, right? Like that, having to go through all of that campaigning and the way that you did it was not the most obvious thing for somebody to do coming back from Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, how, to me, when I came back and I was thinking about how my view of political decisions had changed, I was thinking at the time about, in Missouri, the Republican governor had cut a lot of people very recently off of Medicaid. And I just remember thinking about that in terms of what I'd experienced and thinking about all the different ways they'd used to sell that and just thinking about what an enormous effect that had had, a negative effect in those people's lives. And so that, to me, is how it was a straight line. And so, yeah, so I went out and knocked on a whole lot of doors.
And you had a gimmick.
Are you talking about the mugs?
Yeah.
That's one of the most fun campaigns. I think that may be my favorite campaign.
Well, so the mugs were you and taking photos with people.
Yeah, so my wife and I did that. We've done all the campaigns together, but that was, you know, I knocked on 20,000 doors in that race personally. My wife, Diana, knocked on 8,000 of them with me. My mom knocked on a lot of them with me, and my dad. My mom likes to say she donated 2 good knees to that campaign. And what we would do, you know, I started knocking on doors about a year before the primary. And I knew that, you know, people may or may not remember this kid with a crew cut who was coming by their door a year beforehand. So this was before selfies were a thing. We made these mugs. I'll get to the selfie part in a second. We made these mugs that had the logo on it, or we had these mugs made. And then I'd have a conversation with somebody at the door, and I'd ask them if they'd take a mugshot with me. And then, you know, if my wife was there, she'd take the photo. But if she wasn't there, I had a little digital camera, you know, super cool. It was on my belt, just like the kids were wearing them. Not really.
Next to your BlackBerry on your belt.
I don't think I had room. It was such a, anyway. And so I'd do like a selfie, which I now realize was a selfie. And then would take a photo. And then with about a week left to go in the campaign, what happened was, one, they had the mug, which got into their regular rotation, you know, so they kind of remembered my name that way. But the other thing that happened is, about a week before, they got a personal postcard from me with that photo. And like 1,000 households in the district got a postcard of me and one of the voters in the house. And I still have people when I'm in that neighborhood, if I go to the grocery store there or whatever, I still have people stop me all the time and tell me one of two things. They'll either say, I'm still drinking out of that mug, or, and this cracks me up, do you have any more of those mugs? That's my kid's favorite mug. So
let's fast forward. You were elected to the state house and you're elected secretary of state. You get into the Senate race, and most people are not really thinking about you as being on the radar at all until, I would say, probably summer of last year is when, even in Missouri, but certainly nationally, when people started saying, like, hey, what's going on there? You're running against Roy Blunt. You had a line that you said to me at one point last spring on the phone that you thought that there were a lot of Jason Kander, Donald Trump voters, and I told you that I thought you were being ridiculous. Turns out that you ran 16 points ahead of Hillary Clinton in Missouri, mm-hmm. which means about 220,000 people were actually people who voted for both Donald Trump.
Yeah, more than, I think more than any other competitive race in the country.
Yeah. But you still lost.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Remind you of that.
That's okay. I'm aware.
Now, if you were in any other state, basically, the thinking is there would be another race there that you would go to. But there is another Senate race that's coming up in 2018, but the incumbent, Claire McCaskill, is running for re-election. She's a Democrat. You're not in that race. The governor's race is until 2020. It doesn't seem like running for a House seat would be in your future, but there's also an incumbent Democrat in your local House seat. What is this process like now of sorting this through? Of you're a guy who's interested in politics, you're pretty good at it, it seems, and figuring out what you do with that when there's not a clear place to go to.
Well, look, whenever I've run for office, it's been because there was some change that I wanted to see in the world, and there was an office between me and that change. You know, I when I talk to, you know, high school classes or college, you know, whenever I talk to young people, I always say that you have a choice between, and this is not like my thing, other people say this too, obviously, but I feel it deeply, you can be something or you can do something. And you can go through your life trying to be something, but it's not fulfilling. But if you focus on doing something, things are going to usually work out and you're going to be much happier. And that's what I'm doing. I mean, look, yeah, I lost the Senate race, but I mean, Donald Trump's president of the United States and the Republicans control Congress. I mean, they're trying to take healthcare away from people. There's a lot of really awful stuff happening. So my attitude is, I just want to get up every day and do everything I can to grab an oar and help out. And that's what I'm doing.
I mean, that's for someone who's not officially a politician at this moment, that's sort of a political answer, right? Like you have had two elected positions. You ran for a third. You want to be in office, don't you?
I want to make change where I see change need to be made. And if at some point again in my life that means that there's an office I need to run for, then I will. But I worked really hard for a title once, and it was lieutenant, and then it was captain. And that meant a lot to me because it was physically and emotionally and mentally and spiritually difficult. And since then, honestly, Isaac, I don't care about titles. I mean, yes, there are things.
Well, you care. I mean, you got into the Senate race, right?
Sure, like you've got into. Because I wanted people to call me senator. That's my point. It's like, and it's just, I am in a position right now with what I'm doing with Let America Vote. I think that I feel really deeply right now that I think I'm making a difference in what I'm doing, and I think that I'm focused on things that matter a lot, and that's what matters to me. So. If at some point, again, there's an office between me and a change that I want to see in the world, then that's what I'll do.
Voting was an issue that obviously as Secretary of State, Missouri was part of your job. How is that the thing that you decide, okay, in my post-Senate campaign life, I want to do? I want to make my big focus. Because now you're doing it not just through Let America Vote, but this commission from the DNC. This is it, like voting is your... what you're doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm also, you know, fortunate that folks around the country keep inviting me to come and talk about the future of the party and sort of how we approached our race and my statewide races in Missouri.
Isn't it a little bit ridiculous that, like, they keep asking you, you lost, right? Like,
this is the question you wanted to ask me the whole time, right?
Well, I mean,
isn't this
one of
ridiculous,
the questions.
Jason? Right. This is the whole reason you invited me.
I was in Atlanta at the DNC elections in February, and you spoke. You were officially the keynote address, or it was one of the main speeches. You've been traveling all over the place. You would think that at the DNC elections, the person that they would highlight would be, and not personal, is somebody who would want to race, right?
Yeah.
But you keep getting invitations from all over the place.
All I can tell you is, what people say when they invite us, like why they're inviting me. They say that they want me to come talk about the future of the party, how we were able to, you know, run 16 points ahead. I mean, the other thing is, you know, when I won the Secretary of State's race in 2012, President Obama lost on that same day in Missouri by almost 10. So people, and the other,
so you,
and
you
here's
beaten
the key.
Both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in Missouri.
Well, that's how you can keep score, but that's not how I'm thinking about it. But the other piece to that I think is so important is, you know, I wasn't out there pretending I was a conservative Democrat. I mean, and that I think may be part of it too, is that, you know, I'm somebody who has talked a lot about and has done the act of running as who you are, you know, making a progressive argument even in red states, and then did very well doing that. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, you know, obviously a lot of folks are thinking about engaging millennials. That's something that we did in the campaign. I was the first millennial ever elected to a statewide office. And as far as the voting stuff, to get to your original question before you distracted yourself with the question you truly wanted to ask, was...
I tend to distract myself.
It's quite okay, man. I'm keeping track for you over here.
This is the military training.
It's fine. Anyway, after the election, I looked at a president-elect at the time who was telling what I argue is the biggest lie a sitting president or president-elect has ever told, which is that 3 to 5 million illegal voters voted in the election. And you got to remember, as the chief election official in Missouri, I had a front row seat to a GOP voter suppression strategy that they were trying to perpetrate because of the supermajority Republican legislature. And so I knew what was going on. Everybody else saw a guy who is deeply insecure, who, you know, was lying to his own ego to soothe it about the fact that he lost the popular vote by more than any president in our history. And that still was definitely a factor. But what I saw was more than that, which was somebody who was helping pave the way for them to pass more of these laws that make it a lot harder to vote. That's why you didn't see Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell say, well, that's actually a lie, even though they know it is. Because if you can get that out in the ether and people believe that stuff.
And people believe it.
Yeah, you make it a lot easier to pass those laws. And at the end of the day, what that is that's Donald Trump's reelection strategy. And so to me, it felt like that was the most important thing that I could dedicate time to.
As you said, is the biggest lie that a president or president-elect has ever told. That's a big claim.
I mean, it's hard to think of a bigger one, but the ones that I can think of that rival it were told by the same guy. So, I mean, you know.
Not a Donald Trump fan.
No, I'm not a fan.
He also has a voting security, I'm forgetting exactly how they've called it, but a commission that will look into.
Trump thing?
Yes.
I refer to it as the Voter Suppression Committee to Reelect the President.
Well, it's officially a White House-run yes. government thing, and it's run by an old friend of yours, Chris Kobach.
Old friend, yes.
From the neighboring state of Kansas. He's a Secretary of State. You've had your run-ins with him.
Yeah, I mean, just one in particular. But
what happened?
So when I first got elected Secretary of State, very beginning of my term, so I guess like probably February of 2013, I go out to D.C. for the National Association of Secretaries of State's conference, which is every bit the party that it sounds like it would be.
And it's,
yeah.
I remember once I was interviewing David Patterson when he was lieutenant governor of New York, and he said that he didn't want to go to the lieutenant governor's committee because it sounded like just a bunch of people sitting around waiting for indictments and plane crashes. the Secretary of State convention, I assume, is much more exciting even than that.
You know, if you are really into business registration and securities regulation, yeah. And
the breakout sessions are just.
Fortunately, I was. So, no, but anyway, so I get there. And the thing about NASS, as it's called, is that it's traditionally been, just my understanding, a really nonpartisan sort of association of professionals who just want to talk about best practices to do a good job for their constituents, which is exactly what it should be, right? Well, Kobach had come in and he had sort of a little crew of Tea Party secretaries of state who had been elected recently. And he was trying to turn everything into a way to advance his cause. And even a bunch of the Republican secretaries didn't really like that. So he had this resolution that was to push back on some federal legislation that was being put forward to do things like try and shorten the lines on Election Day, put some good things in place. He didn't like that. So he wanted a resolution that would be passed by the entire body to say that this is only the place for the states, and this is a states' rights thing, and federal government should stay out of the election.
A resolution process. That didn't, I mean, has no, it's just sort of like a press release.
Yeah, he just wanted to waive it and say, look, bipartisan opposition to everything President Obama wants to do here. And he was acting in this, you know, closed meeting of secretaries like this was a truly bipartisan thing to do. And I was saying, no, this is clearly partisan. This is, you Republicans want to do this. And he was arguing, trying to sound very reasonable and saying, well, you're the one making it partisan. I mean, it's not partisan at all. And I said something along the lines of, look, it just happens to be the case that one party wants to keep the federal government out of elections and the other party wants to let black people vote. He did not take well to that comment.
I can't imagine why not.
Yeah. Anyway,
so what happens? What is that not taking well to that look like?
He looked like somebody who was acting very offended at someone pointing out something that was obviously happening.
What's the reaction in the room?
I don't remember that well. You'd have to ask somebody, but I mean, I think people did not feel super comfortable. You know, this is not the kind of argument that people usually had there. And also, a lot of people came up to me and told me that they were really pleased that somebody had spoken up, including a couple of Republicans. So
the resolution did not pass.
It did not pass.
Have you had any conversations with him since then?
I think we may have run into each other a couple of times while I was Secretary of State. We had cordial conversations about our kids.
What does it tell you that he's the person that Donald Trump picked to lead this commission?
It tells me that the commission is exactly what we thought it was. You know, that he is the guy who has been out there doing two things, spreading the lie that voter fraud. I mean, you know, it's important to remember here that statistically, as an American, you are more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to commit voter impersonation fraud. But it's been Kobach out there pushing that. And he's also a guy who spent millions of dollars both trying to make it harder to vote, taxpayer dollars, trying to make it harder to vote in his state, and also trying to prove something that's not true. So it means that they're taking this strategy, which, by the way, is not a policy difference between the parties. It is a political strategy of the Republican Party, no different than where they decide to buy TV ads or send mailers or knock on doors. It is a political strategy about how to keep people who don't vote Republican very often from voting. And they're taking that, and now they're putting the power of the presidency behind it and formalizing it.
And the last thing you do as Secretary of State is give a speech. Not last, but the sort of last official act,
like,
right?
Within the last few days.
Yeah. At the State House. Because you through this quirk, you're the presiding officer, right?
Yeah.
And instead of giving a speech that's like how great Missouri is or whatever, you talk about photo ID.
Yeah, so the Secretary of State, when the new legislature convenes in Missouri, the Secretary of State is like the temporary speaker to sort of preside over the process of them picking a Speaker of the House, which has already obviously all worked out. It's all very ceremonial exclusively, really, right? It's a supermajority Republican legislature. And yeah, I mean, traditionally what you do is you go in and you just talk about how lovely it is that we're all here and you kind of move on.
The show me state, all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, and I said, you know, look, I'm very proud of my state, and I talked about that too, but and I congratulated everybody. But the thing is, I also had heard that, well, I got to give you a little backstory here. So in the previous year, they had been trying to pass, the Republicans had been trying to pass for a long time photo ID. And they finally got to the point where they thought they were going to be able to pass it. They were putting it on the ballot. I don't have to get into all the details, but the short version is they had struck a deal with the Democrats in the legislature in order to pass the bill. And they got them to stop their filibuster. And they made a bunch of concessions in the bill, stuff that the Democrats wanted that would just make it so that fewer people would be disenfranchised to mitigate the damage from the bill. So that happened the previous year, and the bill hadn't taken effect yet. But I was hearing, and a lot of people were hearing, that there was already afoot, you know, within the Republicans in the legislature, sort of this feeling that they wanted to revisit this and they wanted to finish the job. And so I knew that. And I wasn't about to leave office and not call them on it. So, yeah, I did sort of a little brief ceremonial thing at the beginning and then just told them, you're not going to like what I'm about to say. And I gave a speech about voting rights and let them know that though I'm leaving office, I'm going to be focused on this, and I and a lot of other people are going to watch what they do, and they shouldn't go back on their word.
It seemed like that's a boiled down version of, but it was a tough speech, right?
I mean, I had fun.
Yeah. What was the reaction in the room from?
I wouldn't say that they were really no. It was not. They weren't happy.
Were they booing?
I don't think they booed. They tried to, you know, interject with applause at certain points where I would say things that they would try and be snarky.
So
whatever.
They tried to clap to,
yeah, like at one
keep
point
you
I
from
said,
talking?
No, I said something like, you know, I was pointing out, look, under the current system, you've done fine. And I named all the, I mean, they just swept like every office, right? And I was saying, like, you just won. And I named all the offices they won. And so, of course, they applauded that. And I was like, yeah, you can applaud yourselves if you want. I don't care. Like, you're still going to sit there and listen to what I have to say about the right to vote. And what was one point that was kind of interesting is I remember I was saying we've already had this argument in this country. And I said, you know, American heroes, I said something like American heroes face down dogs and batons and hoses to walk across a bridge in Selma. Well, all these, you know, the legislators didn't start the applause, but all their family members are there, right? Because they're there to see their family members sworn in. So the folks in the gallery applauded that line. And so then the legislators kind of were like, okay, I guess I got to. I mean, the Republicans, the Democrats did. But what actually, what happened after that is that I guess they decided not to take up and have a vote on the resolution thanking me for my service. which
it's
I didn't
a real
even,
burn.
I didn't even know that that was a thing. But so that they were.
So that was the punishment.
They were not happy about me pointing out that it would be wrong to take away the right to vote from eligible Missourians.
All right. So that was January. Now we're in New Hampshire. What the hell are we doing in New Hampshire? Why you're here? Because the Manchester Democrats invited you to come. But when politicians come to New Hampshire, people start thinking about just really one topic. And when I talk to people about the possibility that, like, this crazy idea, Jason Kander could run for president, even I get a response that is ranges from like that's crazy to. Is it really that crazy to, well, doesn't that say something about where we are as a party, that that's what we're talking about? So let me put it to you. Did you think about running for president?
I'm really flattered that people are, talk about this or suggest it, or that, you know, then you end up asking that, that kind of thing. I'm really focused on making sure we still hold elections right now. And, you know, and maybe
that,
one day I'll be in
is
one.
Is that hyperbole, that we still
yes,
hold elections?
Is, I hope that that is hyperbole. You know, but, I mean, we have to make sure that people actually get to vote, right? So, like you were asking me earlier about running for office, I want to make sure that elections really still work and are the way they're supposed to go in this country. And I think that's the most important thing I can be doing right now.
That's not a no, right?
Look, politicians never say never to anything, right? But I'm
which
really,
is what politicians who are interested in running for president tend to say.
Look, I'm really focused on what I'm doing. I really am, and I believe in what I'm doing. And I'm honestly really enjoying my work. I would obviously rather Donald Trump not be president, but and that other things be different. But I'm really enjoying my work, and I think it really matters.
You were talking about the future of the party. You talked to people in all these stops about the future of the party. As I said, one of the things that people say when the what's Jason Kander's future conversation comes up is like, isn't it crazy that right now the Democratic Party is in a place where most of the excitement tends to be around Obama, who is not president anymore, Joe Biden, who is not vice president anymore, may decide to run for president, may not. There's a lot of skepticism that he actually will, but one way or the other, he's already 74 years old. And then it's like, to you and a couple of other people who are not that well known, what does it tell you about where the Democratic Party is, that that's the kind of conversation that's where people are thinking, that they're not thinking about people who are senators or mayors or governors or other elected officials?
Well, okay, two things. One, where I want everybody to be thinking right now and where I'm thinking is about 2018. I mean, that's number one. That we need to be focused on winning right now because of the difference. I mean, we got a real shot at taking the House. I mean, that's big stuff. That can make a huge difference in what actually happens. And that's where my focus is. That's where everybody's focus needs to be. I'll tell a story tonight in the speech about a woman I met in Tennessee recently. I went down there to speak to the Democrats there. They had invited me. And this woman named Dawn picks me up at the airport. And somebody else picked me up at the airport. And then she grabbed me. And we were driving around all day. And she was kind of taking me to these events. And I was thinking, Don must be the ace number one super volunteer long time of the Tennessee Democratic Party, because she knew everybody everywhere we went. At the end of the day, she's dropping me off back at the airport for me to go back to Kansas City. And I asked her, I said, Don, how long have you been doing this, like, with the party? And she said, since January 20th, 2017. You know, and she told me that before that, all she'd ever done was vote. But since then, every single day since Trump took office, she had done something that would be activism. And so the number two to what I'm saying here is that I don't really feel like that's what's going on in the party. What you were saying, what's going on in the party is everybody is saying what I was saying earlier, which is this is not a good situation for the country. And it's not just within the party. It's like people coming to the party, people coming not even to the party, just to the movement. Remember, 54% of the folks who voted for somebody not named Donald Trump to be president. And people are just like, okay, where do you need me? What can I do?
Do you feel the question that keeps coming up is whether the Trump voters feel any differently about it? And most of them do not, based on the polls. From people that you're encountering, obviously you had a lot of those Trump voters vote for you. Do you see any sign that the polls are not accurately representing where that is? Or is that right, that Donald Trump is catering to his voters and they're happy this is what they voted for?
I've talked to an awful lot of folks, where I live, who voted for Trump, who are not happy with how things are going. And the thing is you got to remember that.
But he's doing what he said he would in the campaign. So what's the answer that? How do you explain that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that that's right. I mean, when you look at, we could get into that, but Medicaid, all the other stuff he's done that has broken promises. But the big promise that he broke, right, was when he said, I mean, his big, at the end of the day, what the big thing was look, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to fight for you, right? And people have figured out that that's not what he's doing. And at the heart, really, like at the heart of the whole Trump argument was this idea, like, I don't know if you remember when you would talk to folks who were thinking they were going to vote for Trump before the election, a lot of them would say, well, look, he's been very successful. And they set aside a lot of the problems that he obviously presented personally and everything. They, some of them would set it aside and say, because if he, you know, I don't really care if he's not very nice to people, if he's going to do that on behalf of the country and on behalf of me. But what people see now, a lot of people who I talk to, they see that he never made that shift. He's still not nice. He still has all those things that they don't like and never liked about him. But they're not on behalf of the country, and they're not on behalf of them. They're on still on behalf of Donald Trump. He's doing what he always did in business. He's looking out for himself, and he never pivoted to look out. And people, not everyone, but a lot of people are seeing through that. You know, voters are real people, and they don't want to be pandered to. They're not asking you to trick them. That's not what's happening. And they don't need you to agree with them on everything. They need to know that you really believe what you're saying, and they need to know that you believe it because you care about everybody, and everybody includes them. So what I'm saying here, to get more specific, is that if you go out and, like, I'm a progressive, and I went out and I made my argument as a progressive, and I made it no matter what part of the state I was in. Well, so the base looked at that and went, he's for real. Like, I appreciate that he's doing that, right? It doesn't mean I'm catering. I'm saying what I believe. Well, then the folks who didn't necessarily agree with me, I got a lot of their votes because they were like, hey, that guy's telling me the truth. And even though I don't agree with him, I think he believes that because he thinks it'll matter for me and make my life better. And even if he's wrong, like, at least he's trying. And to give you one example, like, to sort of make this tangible on an issue, when folks talk about college loans, for instance, right? A lot of politicians tend to talk about this as an issue that affects millennials or affects students or affects former students or whatever. If you go to small towns in this country and you think about this issue in terms of how it affects small towns, like, this is one of the things that is killing small towns, because folks go off to school and then they accumulate all this debt, and they want to go home and they want to raise their kids near their own parents, but they can't. Right?
Because they need to get a job that pays them.
The wages aren't big enough in their smaller town in order to pay $100,000 in debt. And if you really think about what unites all of us in this country, one of the things that really unites us is what we all basically want is we want our kids' lives to be an upgrade over our own. And if we can get that, then we would really like it if our kids can raise their kids near us. A good life is one where your family is happy, healthy, safe, and nearby. That's a really good life. That's what I want. That's what everybody wants.
There are a lot of people who win races who don't seem to do what you're talking about, though.
Sure. Well, but that doesn't mean that therefore that's why they won. I'm just saying this has worked for me. And I think you were asking what people are responding to. I think it's this. You know, you referenced the ad earlier, the rifle ad. Look, that's an
probably
ad.
The most famous ad of the 2016 campaign, just because of the way it broke through. Which is funny, that at first people were like, what is this ad? And then it's the ad of you. The point was that you were being attacked by the NRA, right? About not being good on guns.
Right. And, like, I had an F rating from the NRA, and they were making sure people knew that. Wayne LaPierre showed up to campaign while they were spending millions of dollars saying I was the enemy on TV. So the point I was going to make that I think gets at what I'm saying is that ad is me saying I'm right about background checks. The NRA is wrong, and I know what the heck I'm talking about, which is a lot different than what maybe a lot of people were suggesting I should do at the time, which is do an ad where I fire a really big gun and talk about how much I love hunting and basically pretend to be a Republican.
So just to check, while we're in Manchester, you're not going to be scouting office space, is that?
No. I'm happy to be everywhere that I am.
All right. Jason Kander, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
And then off he went to the Puritan Backroom, this famous restaurant in Manchester, to speak at the Democratic Club there. You can read a whole article I wrote about that on our site at politico.com. And that has a lot of other people talking about what Kander's up to and how he got adopted into the Obama orbit by former White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, and the way that Joe Biden kept pulling his iPad out to show people that commercial of him taking apart the rifle. You'll also hear what Al Franken thinks of him. Franken called him the funniest Senate candidate that has been around since he's been in the Senate, which, from Al Franken, that's an interesting comment. Thanks, as always, to my producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and our new intern, Rachel Cusick. And remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes.
really great episodes coming up.